We've been reading a letter on Sunday mornings that was not written to us, a letter 2,000 years old, sent from a man in jail to a few of his friends, with no notion at all that 20 centuries later, secretaries and lawyers, school teachers and doctors, businessmen and bus drivers would be trying to discover whether it has anything to say to them. It was written by a man named Paul, first a Jewish rabbi who hated the new Christian sect so much that he tried to kill it by killing its converts, and then, in an extraordinary change, a Christian himself who shaped the church more than any other person in the first 3 centuries of its life. Last week we talked about Paul's irritation with Jewish Christians who were insisting that any pagan who came into the church should first accept some of their old Jewish customs, particularly that mark in the flesh known as circumcision. Paul had come to believe that it is foolish and risky to base one's confidence on external things like that, but he's also a proud, stubborn man, and he cannot resist saying, "Listen, if anyone thinks to base his claim to God's favor on externals, I can make a stronger case for myself than he can. Circumcised on the 8th day, a member of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew born and bred, a Pharisee even, who keeps every little rule and ritual with total fidelity, so full of Jewish zeal that I persecuted the Christians in all matters of legal rectitude, absolutely flawless." In short, if you want a list, I can give you a list. But then he says a remarkable thing. All these assets, all these claims I can make, all these external credits that I can brag about, I consider all of them trash compared with the joy of knowing the free and loving life of Jesus Christ. I'm sure Paul's enemies must have had a field day calling him an extremist. After all, when he was Jewish, he outdid all of his Jewish friends in promoting that religion. When he became a Christian, he gave the same 110%. This was no half-hearted, half-captured kind of man. When he enlisted, he brought every ounce of energy and commitment he had to offer. "How changed my ambitions are," he wrote, surprised at the transformation in himself. "All those honors I used to talk about so proudly now seem no more than trash compared with my desire to know Him." Let's think about that phrase for a moment. To know Him. I am never comfortable with words used so often by preachers that they sound sweet and safe, so conventional in their churchy context that we hear them without thinking much about what they may actually mean. I would let no preacher say to me, "You must come to know Christ," without insisting that he tell me in concrete, clear language what in the world he means by that. And I would insist that what he means makes sense to me. So, what did Paul mean by saying that more than anything else left in his world, he wanted to know Christ? Let's come at it in a roundabout way. The desire to know is one of the glories of human life. The curiosity of children, I think, is one of the most wonderful things on earth. I try hard to remember that. When little Chelsea Elizabeth arrives at my house and goes through it like a small, lovely whirlwind, picking at every loose object in every single room. Up it comes from the shelf, out of the drawer, to be looked at, turned over, balanced, felt, smelled, and no harm done, except that things in our house now tend to stay in place longer than they once did. And in my dotage, I like that, so that there's a little nervous worry that perhaps she'll put something back under a couch or in a corner and we'll never find it again. But she wants to know. How does this work? What is this? Why do you have it on this table? The passion to know, if we don't kill it by dull schools and bad teachers, and we do that, the passion to know makes astronomers who stare out into space to learn how our universe got here. It makes explorers and inventors and scientists and scholars. I want to know. The driving passion of their lives. And for Paul, that was a passion always volcanic in him, except that now the object of that passion has changed. I want to know him. So we're back now to where we began. What does that mean? It sounds pretty, but what does it mean? Surely Paul doesn't want a portrait so that he can stare at it, nor a statue in a garden before which he can genuflect and burn a candle of devotion. He isn't talking of some foggy, fuzzy, emotional feeling about how sweet it is to say the name Jesus and sing songs in a church. No, he makes it clear in his letters exactly what he means. He wants to enter that mind. He wants to penetrate the secrets of that life. He wants to understand how a man could love living as much as Jesus did, and still bless the very people who finally killed him. Paul, we're talking about, who killed other people simply because they left his church for another one. This Paul meets a man who blesses those who took his life. How on earth, Paul must have wondered, can that happen? How does one get to a state of mind like that? Paul, you should remember, never met Jesus of Nazareth in the flesh. He wasn't one of the original 12 who walked by the lake and along the dusty, narrow roads of Judea and finally saw the crossed tree limbs outlined against the sky that morning in Jerusalem. What Paul had met was an idea, or perhaps better, a life unlike any he had ever encountered. And since he no longer had the flesh and blood person One way he could understand the magic of such a life was by watching its effects on the lives of others, in whom the life of Jesus was being reflected. We can learn by indirection. We can know some things by reflected light. My creative writing colleagues explain that often the best way to describe a thing is to describe the effect of it. Chekhov talks about that in one of his letters. He'd been reading a story by a friend of his in which the moonlight was described at great length in a lushly poetic passage. Chekhov wrote, "No, no, not that way. If you want to describe the moon, just mention that the old broken bottle on the side of the mill dam was glistening in the moonlight." The other night, before sleep, I took an old book off the shelf to look at some poetry I had liked to read when I was in school in Texas. I read quite a few of them before I fell asleep, and one of them, by Walter de la Mare, describes moonlight without ever describing the moon. Night in an orchard, under the moon, like this, silver fruit upon silver trees. And a dog asleep in his kennel with only the two front paws out, where the light can touch them, like this, couched in his kennel like a log, with paws of silver, sleeps the dog. A harvest mouse goes scampering by with silver claws and a silver eye, and moveless fish in the water gleam silver reeds in a silver stream. And the mind knows the source of all that silver light. Just as Paul came to know Christ by the light he found in the lives of all those good, brave people he put to death. For Paul, in some fashion, Christ really had been resurrected. He does not seem to think of a physical body when he writes about it, but he is absolutely convinced that the spirit of Jesus of Nazareth had not been conquered, that it lived on, that it lived in him, that it could cause great changes in people's lives. He wanted to know that force, to be shaped by it, to find strength in it, to live with it and walk with it in prison or out, sick or well, every day of his life. I want to know him. I thought of a way yesterday to describe how that kind of thing happens. Dr. Kelly Sowards, distinguished professor at the university, never met the great Dutch Renaissance scholar Erasmus in the flesh. But you will not likely meet a man more filled with the life and spirit of Erasmus than my colleague. He is truly the son of Erasmus, that great thinker's descendant, replicating his mind and spirit, embodying his ideals and attitudes. He would modestly demur if you called him the son of Erasmus, but he would understand the compliment and the truth of it. So when people met Jesus and marveled at the power and beauty of his life, they paid him the highest compliment they knew They called him the Son of God. When Kelly Sowards, a long time ago, was first captivated by the life of Erasmus, he said that I may know him, I will give countless hours of my life to the most intense study. I will drink that life until my own life is filled with it. And that is exactly what Paul did. Until, as he explained it, the life I live is no longer mine. Christ lives in me. And at this moment in our letter, when his mind is filled with the glory of that life which had captured his, Paul writes one of the greatest lines in Christian scripture. Not that I consider myself to have arrived spiritually. I have not yet reached perfection, but I press on, hoping to take hold of that for which Christ took hold of me. My friends, I do not suppose myself to have got hold of it yet. All I can say is this, forgetting what is behind me and reaching out for what lies ahead, I press on straight toward the goal. Those are vigorous verbs. Reach out, press on with hands outstretched, grasping. This doesn't sound much like the casual, relaxed way most of us try to make over what we are inside. We may press and strain toward a goal in school or in business or in a profession, but the creation of character, we are more likely to stroll through that than we are to struggle with it. We need Paul's reminder that integrity is not an accident. We also have trouble forgetting the things we need to forget. So we need to hear Paul closely when he says, forgetting what's behind me, I reach out for what's ahead. It would be nice, of course, if it were that simple. It wasn't, not even for Paul, because in his very last letters, he is still remembering and regretting those Christians he had once hounded to prison and to death. But he remembered only long enough each time to make good use of the memory. It did not cripple him, as our memories sometimes cripple us if we let them. What Paul had broken was his enslavement to the past, that bondage so powerful that one cannot enjoy the present or have hope for the future. I meet people like that. I read a journal once that had been kept for a whole semester by an older student. One of my reactions, the one on the last page, was, all the good things for you seem to lie in the past. You may wish, on some other occasion, to describe how you feel about the present, what hopes you hold for the future. Whether memory is good or bad, we make it servant, not master. We're a long way from Palestine and from Paul, a long way from those Philippians who read his letter, but we could do worse, I think, than adopt the credo by which Paul tried to live. In words like his, it would go like this. We are on a long journey as a church. We have not arrived, but we press on, hoping to take hold of that purpose for which Christ took hold of us. No building, however charming, can substitute for a clear sense of why we are together and what it is we are trying to create. I consider it my sacred task to try to define that and keep it always in your minds. And I consider it your sacred duty to correct me when I am wrong and to care deeply when the words from the pulpit chance to be right. Our brief time together on Sunday morning is not social, it is critical. Amen.